Isaiah is writing at a time when God's people are at a low point. We need to understand that it is nothing new for God's people to be at a low point. We live at a time in which there is the expectation that things will always be the same, and yet the Bible chronicles over and over and over again that God's people drift away and then God calls them back. God's people drift away again and God calls them back over and over through both the Old and the New Testament and then on through church history to this present day. God has worked in that way. And to people who are at a low ebb, God writes and He says, I took you from the ends of the earth. From the farthest corners I called you. I said, you are my servant. I have chosen you. I have not rejected you. So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. All who rage against you will surely be ashamed and disgraced. Those who oppose you will be as nothing and perish. Though you search for your enemies, you will not find them. Those who wage war against you will be as nothing at all. For I am the Lord your God who takes hold of your right hand and says to you, do not fear, I will help you. Do not be afraid, O worm Jacob, O little Israel. For I myself will help you, declares the Lord, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. See, I will make you into a threshing sledge, new and sharp with many teeth. You will thresh the mountains and crush them, reduce the hills to chaff. You will winnow them, and the wind will pick them up, and a gale will blow them away. But you will rejoice in the Lord and glory in the Holy One of Israel. The poor and the needy search for water, but there is none. Their tongues are parched with thirst, but I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the Lord of Israel, will not forsake them. I will make rivers flow on barren heights and springs within the valleys. I will turn the desert into pools of water and the parched ground into springs. I will put in the desert the cedar and the acacia, the myrtle and the olive. I will set pines in the wasteland and fir and cypress together so that the people may see and know, may consider and understand that the hand of the Lord has done this, that the Holy One of Israel has created them. One of the great problems that is faced in the church today is a lack of expectation. It has led to a world of false teaching, to a plethora of false beliefs, and to an attitude that is opposed to God. Because we do not expect God to move, we go about serving Him in our own strength. Or we simply give up and say, this is a hard day, there's nothing that can be done, throw up our hands and turn away. And yet God comes in a time of great hardship and declares, I am at work. I want you to look with me. Look with me over at Hebrews. Look with me over at Hebrews just for a minute. Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Notice the very definition. Often we say, well, I believe God, I have faith. But notice how the Word of God defines faith. Now faith is. Well, what is faith? Is faith merely saying words? Oh, I believe the Bible. I believe God. Is faith merely giving lip service to ideas that we have learned? No, it says now faith is being sure of what we hope for. You see, faith, by definition, has expectancy. Faith, by definition, has expectancy. If you do not have expectancy, you are not living in faith. Faith says what God promised, God will do. What God says, God is going to fulfill. Look with me at the book of Numbers. Listen to this word. It is said by a man who is rejecting God, and yet even he has to acknowledge this truth about God. Numbers 23, verse 19. Numbers 23, verse 19. Numbers 23, 19. God is not a man. One of the problems we have today is we have a view of God that God is just a little bigger than we are. Oh, he's maybe bigger, but only a little. God is not a man. You know, we've made so many illustrations about God. God is like this. God is like that we've brought God down. God is unlike anything you've ever seen. I think of the little things that we do. Somebody says, you know, the Trinity is like water. It's like ice and steam and water. Three. No, it's not. God is not a man. He's not like anything that you've ever experienced or I've ever experienced. He is different than anything that you have ever encountered in this world. God is transcendent. That's one of the first things that we know about God. God is above the creation. He's not part of the creation. God is not a man. Now, there's not one of us in this place who hasn't been let down by people. There's probably not one of us in this place that has not let people down. But God is not a man that he should lie. People say, well, God can do anything. No, God cannot do anything. Well, God's all powerful. He can do anything. No, he cannot. God cannot lie. It's impossible for him. It's not just unlikely. It's not just hard. It's impossible. He can't do it. God is not a man that he should lie. Not a son of man that he should change his mind. God doesn't wake up. You know, you ever do that? You're thinking one way and you're thinking one way, and then one day you just get up and you go, you know, I need to do something different. We do that in all kinds of ways. That's why people change jobs. One day, boy, and the next day, I'm off working someplace else. But God doesn't change His mind. That's why God didn't let go of Israel. You read through the Old Testament, and there is one profound thought that you reach by the time you get to the end of Malachi, and that is, why didn't God give up on Israel a long time ago? Read through the Gospels. There is one profound truth you get when you read through the Gospels. Not only is Jesus great, but His followers are pretty stupid. I mean, the fellow that led me to Christ used to say about me, Jenkins, you have hoof and mouth disease. And boy, did I. Every time I opened my mouth, it wasn't a question of what I'd put in it, it was a question of how many. And you know, you read the Gospels. I mean, they can't say a word right. They are just... By the end of the Gospels, if somebody would have said, Jesus, you're going to put these guys in charge of building your church, they'd have said, Jesus, you're nuts. Let's see. Peter can't keep his feet out of his mouth. Peter didn't have hoof and mouth disease. He had hooves and mouth disease. It wasn't a question of would he put his foot in its mouth. It was, would he get the other one in there beside it, and would he ever remove them? Jesus, you won't go to the cross. Here they are. Jesus is going to the cross, and they're arguing, who's going to be the greatest, Jesus? I mean, they are just... But God doesn't change His mind. When He latches on to someone or something, He holds on to it. That is why Lamentations 3, 22 and 23 says, it is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed because His compassions do not fail. God is not a man that He should lie. He's not a son of man that He should change His mind. Does He speak and then not act? Now, we live in a day in which that seems to be the attitude of the church. God speaks, but then He won't act. That's why we have so little prayer in the church, because we don't expect God to act. You see, when you expect God to act, when you expect God to move, then you're there pleading before His throne, because that's what He said to do. But if you're not expecting God to act, then you go about doing it yourself. We have the problem that old Samuel had. Well, look with me. Boy, I didn't have any of this down, but you know, this is just... Look at the problem that Saul had. Saul is made king of Israel. It's over in 1 Samuel. First Samuel chapter 13. God had said that He would drive out the Philistines. So Saul gathers an army and he goes out, and Samuel, the prophet of God, says, I will come and I will entreat the Lord. But I want you to notice what it says in the middle of verse 7, it says, Saul remained at Gilgal, and all the troops with him were quaking with fear. You see, they weren't expecting God to move. You cannot be afraid when you're expecting God to move. They were quaking with fear. He waited 7 days. I've waited long enough. Let me ask you, how many days is your limit of waiting for God? How long does it take you in waiting to God before you stop expecting Him to move? Their limit was 7 days. He waited 7 days, the time set by Samuel. But when Samuel did not come and Saul's men began to scatter. Isn't it amazing how God's people scatter because they don't expect Him to move? We live in a day in which God's people are scattering right and left. I hope it's not true about Ray Bolts. But you know what? If it is true, and I hope it's not, there's a lot of rumors that float around the internet. And we need to not give credence to every rumor on the internet. If we followed every rumor on the internet, you know, things would be a lot different than they are in reality. But if it is true, you know, it wouldn't be the first time, and it won't be the last. And that's nothing new. It says right here, Saul's men began scattering. You know, it is not that hard to scatter God's people because God's people don't expect God to move. And we set a time and we say, God, if you move... Now, we seldom say that out loud. We wouldn't be that crass. I've noticed a real fall off on the late night prayer that we have with several churches. This last month, again, there were about 8 or 10 people there. And I know that someone says, well, you know, this month wasn't, but the last 3 months. I was real heartened Friday night. The first time we've had a full room of prayer in a long time. But you know, we stop expecting. And once we stop expecting, we stop asking. And once we stop asking, we scatter. Numbers tells us God is not a man that He should lie. He's not a son of man that He should change His mind. Does He speak and then not act? Does He promise and not fulfill? Let me ask you, what do you expect God to do? What do you expect God to do in your life? Do you expect Him to make you a man, a woman of God? Do you expect that is going to happen? Well, it would be really nice. That's not expectation. Look at Matthew 16, 18. 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 Here's what Jesus said. Matthew 16, 18. And I, Jesus is speaking, and I tell you that you are Peter. And on this rock, if everything goes well, and nothing withstands me, and the culture doesn't fight against me, and Satan doesn't oppose me, I might build my church. That's what it says, right? Jesus said, on this rock, I hope I'm going to be able to build my church. Please, guys, won't you side with me? Is that what he says? I will build my church. And as long as the gates of hell don't really gather together, they won't stand up against it. Oh, I just hope those gates of hell just don't really get going. Oh, if they get going, I'm in trouble. That's what it says, right? And the gates of hell will not stand against them. Now let me ask you, do you expect that to happen? Do you expect that to happen? Do you expect that Jesus is going to build His church? Well, you see, these are the last days and it's going to be hard, and I tell you that you're Peter, and on this rock I'll build my church until the last days, and then my power will fade away and I won't be able to. Right? Well, but you know, these are dark days. What's the Bible say about dark days? In whom you are children of light, who shine forth in the darkness more and more. How many stars are there in the sky up there right now? All of them. You just can't see them. But you know, the darker it gets, what happens? The more they shine. And you know, around here it never really gets dark. There's those street lamps, and everybody's got to have, you know, wobber lamps, light up the yard, like. And there's Philadelphia over there, and you know, you just look and you see this glow of light on the horizon. That's Philadelphia, and there's Camden up there, another glow of light. It doesn't, but boy, you get out in the wilds where it's dark, where the coyotes chase you. Right, Troy? Amen. But you were there at the door when they came running in. Didn't they just about knock you? Weren't you the one that they just about knocked over coming through the door? Yeah, oh yeah, they guys. How many of them were not scared? It was fun afterwards. It's really fun to tell the story. I will build my church. It will overcome the gates of hell. That's why the psalmist, look with me at Psalm 5. Look with me at Psalm 5. Here was the attitude the psalmist has. Psalm 5. Psalm 5. Now, the psalmist is not living in great days. He's living in days when things are rough. Sometimes we get the idea that, you know, oh, we couldn't be like those people in the Bible. You know, they walked on water. Well, only one of them. Psalm 5. Give ear to my words, O Lord. Consider my sighings. You ever feel like all you can do is sigh? Just beat down, worn out. That's what the psalmist says. Consider my sighing. Listen to my cry for help. God doesn't despise a cry for help. My King and my God, for to you I pray. In the morning, O Lord, you hear my voice. You ever get up in the morning and you just go, oh. In the morning I lay my requests before you. But I want you to notice what he says. And wait in expectation. Oh, God's power's gone. You know, he parted the Red Sea and now he's running on empty. No! I wait in expectation. God, what are you going to do next? What are you going to do next, God? When are you going to do it? Let's look at Isaiah 41 because I want to give you some principles. Isaiah 41. Look at Isaiah 41. I want to look at three questions. I want to look at three questions. When does God move? When does God move? When does God move? Look at verses 11 and 12. He says, all who rage against you will surely be ashamed and disgraced. Those who oppose you will be as nothing and perish. Though you search for your enemies, you will not find them. He says, first of all, I move when you're surrounded by enemies. Notice he doesn't say, before you have an enemy, I'll move. No, he moves when you're surrounded by enemies. And you know, the church today is surrounded by enemies. I was listening to a secular broadcast. This was not a Christian broadcast. It was a secular broadcast. And one of the things they were saying, just like we read in Church Around the World in Italy today, that there is a new force of militant atheism that is rising up in America. There are a new crop of militant atheists who are determined to destroy all vestiges of Christianity from the culture in America. That is a reality. We are surrounded by cults and false teachers, and the false teachers and the cults seem to spring up like weeds every day. There are a multitude of enemies, so we should just wring our hands and give up because, you know, we're surrounded. No! When you're surrounded by enemies, that's when God moves. That's the very time to look for Him. Look at verse 14. He says, do not be afraid, O worm. Now, this isn't the only time in the Bible that people are referred to as worms. The psalmist on a number of occasions calls himself a worm. Jesus said, quoting the Psalms, at the time, right before his crucifixion, I am a worm and not a man. Now, what is true about worms? You know, there's the old saying around, you know, you're as low as a snake's belly in a wheel rut. But you know, snakes may go low. They may crawl on the ground, but worms go lower. They crawl through the ground. Worms aren't even on top of the ground, they're underneath the ground. God's saying, you've hit the bottom, you've burrowed through the floor, you've dug through the foundation, you've hit the dirt, and you're still going down. That's when I'm going to move. And a lot of times we want God to move when we're up, and when He doesn't, when we hit the bottom, we say, well, God's chance is over. Guess He can't move now, but God says, no, when you're as low as you can go, that's when I move. When you're the worm on the ground, when you're the worm in the dirt, when you've burrowed through the floor and you don't know how much lower you can go, when you've hit the bottom and then gone a few more feet, that's when God moves. Look at verse 15. See, I will make you a threshing sledge, a new and sharp with many teeth, and you will thresh the mountains and crush them. When you're facing mountains, God moves. God doesn't move when you're on the plane, when you're just rolling along, la-di-da. When you're facing mountains, that's when God moves. Look at verse 17. The poor and the needy search for water, but there is none. You see, Israel's a desert. I don't know, who here has actually been in a true desert? Some of you. Some of you haven't. You've never been thirsty till you've been in a desert. I mean, every breath you take, you ever been in one of those hot boxes? It's not a sauna, it's not a steam room because it's not steam, it's that dry heat. With the wood, are they a sauna? And just every breath is so dry, your nose starts to just dry out and it's just sticky and your tongue, and that's how it is in the desert. You go to Israel, it's worse because you go down near the Dead Sea, which is the worst of the desert in Israel, and there's this alkali and all these chemicals in the air from the salt, and it's not table salt that's in the Dead Sea. It's not salt water in the sense that it's potassium, that it's sodium chloride. Table salt, you can't eat it. It's all kinds of poisonous salts, potassium chloride and manganese chloride, whole bunch of other kinds of very caustic salts. In fact, just a couple ounces of Dead Sea water, were you to drink it, you'd be dead in just a very short amount of time. It's very, very deadly. But it just, it closes you up. And you take a drink of water, and as soon as you swallow it, you're thirsty again. And the rich, they bought up the water holes. Their property were the ones with the water. If you were a poor person, you couldn't afford a property with water. You had the property without the water, and you were always thirsty. And he's saying, the poor and the needy, they search for water, but there's none. Their tongues are parched with thirst. But I, the Lord, when you're poor, when you're needy, when you're thirsty, how thirsty are you for God to move in your life right now? How much do you need God to move in your life? Well, I'm okay. I can handle it. I've got my things I can turn to. I've got my backup plans. I've got my friends. I've got my job. Nick and I were sharing last night with Gene the story of Jerry Roscoe. How he'd always say, well, my family has deserted me, my kids have, but I've got my job and I've got my house and I've got my car. He went to work. They met him at the gate, handed him some shoe boxes full of stuff and said, you're fired. Don't come on the property or we'll arrest you. He said, that's all right, I've still got my house. And he drove to his house and he was met at the door by the sheriff, who handed him the papers and said, you can't go in the house, it's been foreclosed. And the sheriff's deputies are dumping stuff in the yard. And as he's picking up the stuff from the yard to shove in his car, the wrecker comes around the corner and hooks up with his car and drives away with it. How thirsty are you? Or are you? Do you say, well, I'm not quite there yet. I've got someplace else to turn. That's the problem in the church today, is we have someplace else to turn. Then verse 18, Look at verse 18. It says, I will make rivers on barren heights and springs. I will turn the desert into pools of water. God works when we're in the desert, when we're on the barren heights. That's when God works. Have you admitted you're in a desert? Most of us don't want to admit that. Oh, it's not that bad. It'll be okay. But when we say it's a desert, that's when God works. What does God do when He works? What does God do when He works? Let me show you four things God does when He works. The first thing He does, look at verse 13. Look at verse 13. Verse 12. Though you search for your enemies, you will not find them. God disgraces enemies and drives them away. I love the attitude of the Apostle Paul. The Apostle Paul says we're surrounded, but never in fear. We're beat down, but never abandoned. And you know, 2,000 years have passed, and everyone's saying that poor Apostle Paul, those great Roman emperors, boy, weren't they great? Or does everybody now in the world say, you know, those Roman emperors were a bunch of mad idiots? God disgraced the enemies. And He will disgrace His enemies today and tomorrow and the next day, and no one remains an enemy of God that God does not disgrace them. There's a warning in that, because God doesn't say I'll disgrace the enemies that I don't like, but I'll tolerate the enemies. And there's a lot of times we want to act like God's enemies and yet have God's favor. If we make ourselves enemies of God, then we will be disgraced as well. Doesn't matter whether we call ourselves Christians, whether we sit in a church. If we act like enemies of God, He'll treat us that way, because God disgraces His enemies. Look at verse 15. Second of all, He says, I will make you a threshing sledge, new and sharp, with many teeth, and you will crush. You will thresh the mountains and crush them. God breaks down mountains. In fact, this is what Jesus says about faith. Look with me at Matthew chapter 17. Matthew chapter 17. Jesus has been on the Mount of Transfiguration, and three of the disciples have been there with Him. They've seen Moses, they've seen Elijah. They've seen Jesus in His glorified body. They thought they had it made. They try to rebuke a demon. They try to drive it out. Nothing happens. Verse 19, then the disciples came to Jesus in private. They didn't ask this in public. They knew they'd screwed up somewhere. They didn't want to make it a public embarrassment. Why couldn't we drive it out? And Jesus just lays it out straight. He says, because you have so little faith. I got a question sometimes where our faith would rise on Jesus' faith-o-meter. Let me ask you, where would your faith fall on Jesus' faith-o-meter? Jesus said of these men who had given everything to follow Him, people who probably hadn't seen their family in several months, who had risked persecution, who had watched people try to kill Jesus and had been right there with Him. People who had given Him everything, He said to them, because you have so little faith. I got to ask us pretty honestly here, how much faith do you have? How much faith do I have? Where would we rank on Jesus' faith-o-meter? He says, I tell you the truth, if you had faith as small as a mustard seed. Do you know how small a mustard seed is? A mustard seed is so small that they don't sell them by the individual mustard seed. You can't pick up, even, you know, take your finger and you can't pick up a single mustard seed. You know those little black seeds on the rolls, those little and poppy seeds, they're huge compared to a mustard seed. You know how they sell mustard seed? They take some kind of sticky stuff like honey or butter and they slather it onto a piece of paper and they just dump the mustard seeds on that. And then you just cut off a section of it to plant the mustard seed. And you get hundreds of seeds every time because they're so teeny, weeny, tiny. He said, if you had faith like a mustard seed, so small you can't even see it with the human eye if there's just one of them. I mean, a mustard seed makes a fly speck seem like a mountain. As small as a mustard seed, you would say to this mountain, move over here. And it would move. Nothing would be impossible for you. Now, Jesus wasn't talking about physical mountains because, you know, there isn't a time in the Bible where Jesus or any of his disciples ever told mountains to dance around for the fun of it. When I was a young Christian, I used to sit up there in the mountains and I'd go, ooh. Woo-ha! I got faith. I just moved that. That wasn't the kind of mountain Jesus was talking about. But the mountains he was talking about were just as real. Mountains of unbelief. False religion. Apathy. Lives turned away from God. People just like that little child who were demon-possessed. Said you'd move that mountain. God breaks down mountains. That's what he does when he moves. Number 3, verse 17, Isaiah 41. The third thing he does, Isaiah 41, 17. Verse 18, I make rivers flow on barren heights. Rivers don't flow on barren heights. Rivers don't flow on heights at all. Rivers flow in valleys. Water seeks the low ground. You might have a little spring on the heights that feeds down and someplace downhill along, long, it becomes a river. But God says, I make rivers on the heights. You know, one of the things that we do is we ask for just little tiny things. God says, I'm into rivers. Number 4, he says, I turn the desert into pools of water. Deserts don't have pools of water. They certainly aren't full of them. If they were, they wouldn't be desert. But God says, I turn deserts into pools of water. But here's the question, why does God do it? Here's the $10,000 question, why does God move? Isaiah gives us 3 answers. And they're often not the reasons that we want God to move. Often we want God to move for our sake. God, I'm hurting. God, I'm upset. God, I feel beat down. God, do it for me. Me, 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 me. I remember listening this week, and for those of you who haven't been at Bible study on Tuesday night, you missed a couple of great nights. I had to turn the video back, so I don't have it, but you missed out with the testimonies of those guys from Angola. To see how God is working in this country, where people have the faith to really call out to Him. And the difference that only a handful of people made. There were only a handful of people that started praying in Angola. One group, there were five guys. There's a lot more five of us here if we had the kind of expectation that they had. Why does God move? He doesn't move because we're selfish. The one guy says, you know, I've always prayed. I prayed, God, give me a new car. God, get me out of this trouble. God, give me that. God, give me this other thing. God, do this for me. God, get me out of trouble. I prayed all the time, he says. But I want you to notice that that isn't the kind of prayer that God hears. God does it for three reasons. Look with me first at the end of verse 16. Why does God thrash the mountains and blow them away? But you will rejoice in the Lord and glory in the Holy One of Israel. God does it for His glory, that we rejoice in Him. When you rejoice in your car, or you rejoice in your answer to prayer, you rejoice in what God does, but you don't rejoice in Him. God doesn't move, because God does it so that we can have Him. I don't want God. I just want my car. I want a new car. I want a Corvette. Who was talking to me and said that they'd been trying to get a Corvette for 40 years. Well, let's see. If they started when they were 16, that would make them in their 50s. You know, there's nothing sadder than seeing a 50-year-old, usually with their shirt unbuttoned down to about here. And you know, there ought to be a law about who can unbutton their shirt. Because, I mean, most of the guys that do it just shouldn't. With a gold chain, and they're dry, and gray. No, it's not gray hair. It's not gray hair, but you know that it's not gray hair because somebody put a bottle on it. And they're sitting in their Corvette like, ooh, I'm 20. And they ain't. What do you rejoice in? What do you rejoice in? You see, God moves so that you will rejoice in Him and glory in Him. God does it so that He receives the glory. Is your life about glorifying God? Or is your life all about me, 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 mine, 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 mine? I remember a person I used to know, and you'd ask them, how you doing? They'd go, oh, I'm just counting blessings. Everything in their voice said, that's the one thing I ain't doing. Is your life glorifying to God? God says, that's why I move. Look at verse 20. He says, why do I do all of these things? So, that's a why question. Why does He disgrace enemies, break down mountains, pour out water, turn deserts into ponds? Why does He do that? So that people may see. God does it so that people see Him. Let me ask you, do people see God when they look at you? Do they see God when they look at you? You see, God moves so that He will be seen, not so that we will be seen. So that people may see and know and consider and understand. God does it to open people's minds. There's a lot of people that have closed minds today. Their minds are just closed to the truth of God. How come it is that God is the last option on the agenda? And then maybe not. How many people do you know their lives are a shambles? And you say, turn to Christ. And they go, no. What you going to do then? Oh, I'll just kill myself. Well, let's see. Turn to God or kill yourself. Oh, kill yourself. I mean, they won't even take God as the last resort. Does it so that people will consider. One of the best verses in the whole Bible comes from the Gospel of Luke, the prodigal son, Luke chapter 15. The Bible says, here he is in a pig trough in a far country eating pig slop after the pigs have wallowed in it. Now, you've got to be pretty low. I grew up around cows, and cows aren't pigs, but I'll tell you what, I wouldn't eat at what the cows were eating after the cows ate it. And we had these special things to keep them from walking where they ate. They're called stanchions. And I still wouldn't eat it. You got to be pretty low to eating where the pigs ate after the pigs ate. But here's the wonderful verse. The wonderful verse is the Bible says he came to himself. He said, this is stupid. You see, God moves so that people will consider. They'll think about it. They'll think about it. Let me ask you as we close. How much do you expect from God? How much are you expecting from God right now? Have you given a whole bunch of reasons? I remember in the pastor's group that I'm part of, Phil showed part of that video about Angola prison in Louisiana. And one of the pastors said, well, you know, that would work for them because, and he began to give a whole list of reasons why they could turn to God. You know, they don't have anything else and they're locked in prison. And I spoke up and said, yeah, but there's a lot of people in prison that never turn to God. Is this just an excuse for us to say, well, we can't have what they have because we're not ministering to people in prison? If we could just get our whole congregations in prison, then they'd get right with God. Well, that's not exactly what I'm saying. Yeah, it is. How much do you expect from God? Well, it'll be different when this changes. When my family gets right. When I don't have to deal with this problem. You know, I would be expecting God, but you don't understand what I'm dealing with. God says, I don't care what you're dealing with. God is not a man. Did you read the little thing in the bulletin? Wrong bulletin. Here's the bulletin. Did you read the thing in the bulletin? Bob and Marge Lacey. Bob is dying of, what is it, lung cancer? Is it lung? I read it, lung cancer. It's over. Why have we served God? No! Read it. We're ready to finish out this life. Oh God, why did you give me lung cancer? No! Anybody here say, oh, what I'm facing is a whole bunch worse than terminal lung cancer? Anybody here say that? Bob's saying, God's able to move. I've got lung cancer. But God's going to move. What do you expect from God? Let's bow together. Lord, you are not a man that you should lie. You are not a son of man that you should change your mind. Have you said and will you not do it? Have you spoken, and will you not keep your promise? God, we don't expect enough of you. Lord, I have seen with my own eyes, I have felt in my heart the decline in expectation that right here in this place has been manifest. Lord, today I pray that you would move in our lives to change our attitude and give us an attitude of expectation. In Jesus' name, amen.